Stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
Bubonic plague, the good old Spanish Inquisition, parasites, gruesome deaths, depravity, torture, pandemics, psychopaths, cannibalistic cults, and that's just for starters. So we're going to discuss plot devices that are intended to make your readers squirm. Talk about how uncomfortable you can make them. Are there lines that really you just shouldn't cross? Are there points that you reach where that's just far enough? And is there anything at all just totally off limits? So to start with, we'll go ahead and introduce ourselves. We'll start at that end.
I'm Stephen D. Sullivan. I've been in publishing since I joined TSR in 1980 as an editor to work on Dungeons & Dragons. Since then, I've worked in comics and games, and most recently, in the last 10 years or more, as a novelist. I've had more than 30 books published, plus anthologies and short stories and stuff like that. I'm also a micro-publisher around a company called Walkabout Publishing. Some of you may be familiar with me, if not from my books, then from my long-running comic strip, The Random Dragon Magazine, The Twilight Empire, now available in glory in black and white for the first time ever.
I'm Lawrence C. Connolly. My stories have been in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Cemetery Dance, Amazing Stories, Twilight Zone, most of the major magazines and anthologies, many of the Martin Greenberg anthologies. Those stories have been collected in a number of collections. One, This Way to Egress from Ash Tree Press, and another, Visions from Fantasist Enterprises. There's also a new book coming out this fall called Voices. And also have a collection of novels called The Veins Cycle. Veins and Vipers are both out now. Vortex is out next year. Oh, and I'm doing a reading mark. Cool. Come around, I'll read some of those things.
And my name is Mark Kasson. I have short stories that have appeared in a number of anthologies. I've written for role-playing games. I've done some editing, both anthology and role-playing editing as well. Written for Esley Multiplayer Online game, where I got to write 11,000 words on describing rain in different settings. Very interesting stuff. But that's sort of a rundown. So we're going to be talking about making your readers squirm. And I guess to start with, do you guys do a lot of squirm-inducing in your writing?
You know, I was wondering about that when I saw I was on this panel. I thought, well, what have I done that really make readers squirm? And then I was like, well, I did two stories that were basically kind of 10 little Indian and see how many ways I could kill the characters and see who was left at the end. So I've done those, and I'm working on a horror series now. And, you know, I'm not sure if squirm is always what I'm trying for. I think generally as writers we try to evoke emotions in our readers. And sometimes that emotion can be, this is really disgusting, this is a horrible thing. I'm working on a series of horror novels right now where I'm trying to push a lot of those buttons. I'm trying to make people uncomfortable. I'm trying to deal with subject matter that I don't normally deal with, you know, in terms of both sex and violence, which are both things that make readers squirm. So I'm working on it.
Do I make people squirm? How much time do I have? Give me five.
If he talks long enough, we'll all squirm.
Give me 5 minutes. Tomorrow, I'll be reading some scenes that are designed to make people squirm in a good way. I think making people squirm is pretty much my stock and trade. I learned everything about how to make people squirm when I was 10, 12 years old. Now here's a story for you, it's a true story. I'm 12 years old and I'm growing up in Levittown. Now Levittown is this huge, sprawling place where everything's the same. You know, all the houses are the same, all the gardens are the same, the guy next door looks just like you. Everybody's the same. You can't find any weirdness. So what did the kids do? They created weirdness to entertain each other. Now the kid next door, named TC, he and his older brother Bill decided to make something called the Haunted Attic. Now the attics in Levittown were really just these rooms on the second floor that had insulation and boards and beams in them. And so he puts a sign on the front of his house and it says Haunted Attic. And it's got a picture of the mummy beating the tar out of Dracula. Now right away I'm intimidated because you know the mummy, he's slow and he's not real frightening, but here's Dracula getting beat up. And so I'm squirming a little bit just by looking at that picture. So anticipation is an important part of it. And below it says Haunted Attic, 5 cents. So I pay my 5 cents and I go in the door and I go up the steps and I get up to the top. And there is a closed attic door, and on the front of that is another picture, and this time it's Frankenstein beating the crap out of the Wolfman. You know, the Frankenstein monster beating the crap out of the Wolfman. And it says, enter if you dare. That's Dante Alighieri, isn't it? You know, abandon hope, all ye who enter. It's anticipation. I'm not doing anything creepy yet, but I am squirming. And I'm second in line. And there's 10 kids behind me, and we're all kind of squirming, and we're listening to the door, and we hear these sounds inside, we're wondering what in the world could be in there, we're talking to each other, we're trying to anticipate what could be next, and that's what it's all about, it's anticipation. So, the door opens, the guy in front of me, every other kid in Levittown was named Tom, so this kid was named Tom, the kid behind me was named Tom, my best friend Tommy, he's in front of me, door opens. And there's TC with a skeleton mask on, a skull mask on. He looks out and he points at him and he says, first victim. Well, that's good. I'm the second in line. I'm really intense. And I'm peeking in. I'm trying to see what's in there. And I see some shadows in the background, some vague and nebulous shapes. And the door closes and there's silence. And I hear the sound. I can still hear the sound today. It's a little squeaky sound, kind of like a spring or maybe a wheel. And there's silence. And then, boom! And then, a scream! And then, there's banging on the door. Let me out of here, let me out of here, let me out of here! Okay, finally the door opens, Tommy goes tearing down the hall, down the steps, and he's gone! You think I'm not squirming? I'm the next guy in line. The door opens again. There's that skeleton mask, and my friend TC's eyes are looking out of the socket holes, and he says to me, next victim. This is what we do as horror writers. Think about it. Nothing's happened, really. It's just all anticipation. I went inside. I saw a wooden chair sitting on casters. I sat on that baby. It made that sound. That little squeaky sound. The lights go out. And at that point, my friends, I learned the true nature of horror at the hands of TC and his brother Bill.
And
see, at some point the squirming's got to end, and I gotta tip my hand, right? Once I do that, you stop squirming, things are not that frightening, and at that point you say, oh, that's what it was. I thought it was going to be something worse, and there's relief. So this is what telling these stories is all about. It's about building that anticipation, details, and the sense of something about to happen. And you just play that out as long as you can, because the reveal, when you give it, is never going to be as remarkable as the build-up. That's what TC taught me. And what was TC doing? He's beating the crap out of those kids. Boom! The first boom is the chair being pulled out from under me, and I'm being kicked. And I'm kicking back, and I'm screaming, let me out of here, let me out of here, let me out of here. And the kids outside, they're thinking, ooh, this must be good. TC must have made about a buck in nickels that day before somebody wised up and said, I'm not going in there. And you know what? As long as people are willing to pay some money for some cheap thrills, I'm going to be making people squirm.
I've got nothing. You know, and I think one of the most interesting things there for me is that the squirm isn't really, there's sort of a difference between squirm and shock. And, you know, shock can be, oh, I blast a guy, he blows to pieces, the guts go on the wall. But then there's squirm, and you know, for me, there's kind of a difference there. And the anticipation is part of it. You don't really anticipate the sort of shock value of just seeing someone blown away, you know, or some monster just rips the guy apart and everyone's screaming. But that anticipation, what's in your mind, is always so much more frightening. I mean, do you guys have different ways that you sort of, techniques you use to build that up so that when the reader gets there, they're absolutely squirming in their seats?
You know, it's funny, I don't really think about it that much. I've been a huge horror movie fan, literally ever since I can remember, since I've been a little kid. So in terms of me personally, you really have to kind of work hard to get me to squirm. But at the same time, I've spent a lot of time observing, and I think the anticipation you were talking about is right. And I think one of the reasons that works, and it was utilized for me to great effect by H.P. Lovecraft, is not telling you things, is hinting at things, is pointing at things, and then not revealing them. I mean, in some sense, the best horror work, it's all in your mind anyway. And if you can actually lead the people to the conclusion without ever telling them the conclusion, because I was thinking, he's probably beating kids up.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're talking about Lovecraft. That I live in Michigan, and I live in an area, there's a lot of rural space around us. And there's a lot of abandoned farmhouses out in between. The big tall trees have overgrown, and the vines have grown up, and the paint has peeled off and faded, and the floors have sort of sagged. After reading that Lovecraft compendium and every story in there, every one of those houses freaks me out. And it doesn't matter what's in it. It doesn't matter that it's just somebody's old farmhouse. They're all scary now. So you're right. Right. Not really seeing the thing that's scary can be very
scary. Right, yeah. I mean, reading those stories late at night, reading rats on the walls in an old house, and suddenly, you know, there's squirrels on the roof. But there's nothing quite like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for me, I think a good example of how this is done well is Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. And there's a scene in the novel, and there's a comparable scene in the film.
The Robert Wise version,
yes. And they're both masterfully done. And it's a good study in squirm-inducing scenes if you read the book and focus on that scene, and then you watch the film and then play that similar scene back. I won't spoil the Shirley Jackson scene for you. If you've read it, you know what I'm talking about. There's a remarkable build-up and an absolutely killer last line to this chapter, which is in the middle of the book, where Eleanor and
the hand-holding scene.
That's it. Eleanor and Theodora are alone in the room, and there's a sound outside. And there's these sounds. The sounds keep getting stranger and stranger and stranger, and they're holding each other's hands in the dark, and it just builds wonderfully. But in the Robert Wise film, there is a closed door to the room, and the details, the action, you know, builds gradually to a crescendo. And first we hear something in the hall, and then we see shadow under the door, something going by. And Eleanor turns to Theodora and says, "Is that door locked?" And of course, the next thing that we see is that the knob jiggles a little bit, and the door opens. Perfect time. And we have the door, you know, shakes a little bit, and then it shakes a little bit more, and they're getting more and more scared. And then, those of you who've seen the film, you know this, the door starts to, you know, come inward. It starts to bend inward, as if some massive weight is leaning against this door, and it starts to look as if the door is breathing. There's something incredible out here. And then finally, at the end of the scene, when the door opens, it's just somebody standing out there saying, "What's all that screaming about? How come you're, what are you so frightened about in here?" So when the door finally opens, whatever was there in the hall is not there. Now, this is what horror writers try to do, is try to keep that squirm going and then hold off the reveal as long as possible. And I think that both the book and the film are really things that we as writers should study if we want to see how to do that. But I believe that Squirm is not about the violence itself. It's not about the gore or the bloodshed. It's about the threat of those things. Because when those things happen, there's no squirming, although there might be disgust. But then there's a release at that point. So we try to hold off that as long as possible.
Because once you see what you're afraid of, you may go into fight mode. And at that point, you're ready to fight back against it. You're getting tough against it. Your mind is hardening against it.
Exactly.
And you're no longer just fearing it and wondering if you'll survive. One thing about preparing for it that I think is important, too, is that I think that it takes patience. I really appreciate when an author takes the time to slowly seed in the elements that are necessary to build to that moment where the door is shaking, the thing where, you know, maybe the first time they enter into a place there's some slight fear or something sort of surprises them slightly or a slight hint. I mean, there's really heavy-handed ways you can do it, like, and all the doors had horrors behind them, and then the guy goes up and here's a door, and you know, you don't want to do it that way. But I think it's important. I think it's important to be patient about it. Otherwise, I don't think you'll get it. Your reader won't be ready for it at that point. You sort of have to bring them along slowly, I think.
Yeah, I work with students who want to have something incredible happening on the first page. Always something incredible happening. And I think that that's not the way to go. You need to have dynamics in your writing, and the slow build is something that the horror stories do well. I was talking in the last panel about a scene from a Fritz Leiber story. I'm blanking on the title, but it's the story where, and this is a very squirm-inducing story, where Fritz Leiber looks out his window, or the protagonist looks out his window, and across the city, miles away, there's a radio antenna, and beside the antenna, there's this mysterious creature, and it's staring at him from miles, a couple miles away. And he can see it just enough to know that it's staring at him, and this begins to bug him out. And so what he does is he goes over there. Right? One day he decides he's going to ride the bus over there, he's going to climb up that hill, he's going to go see what this thing is. And he gets up there, he knows exactly where he is. He's now right beside the antenna. It's the same antenna he's looking at from his room, and that thing's not there. He turns around, he looks towards his apartment, things in his room and staring at him. No blood, no violence at all. But it's squirm-inducing, I think.
Now, I was looking at a description, though, but I think maybe there is, though, a place where there is sort of that drawn-out, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening, and you are stuck. And I think that might be part of, if you are going to have the gore and you want them to keep squirming, I think you have to make the reader feel like they can't get away.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if they feel like they can escape the thing, then at that point, they're it's flight. But if they're stuck there and it's drawing them through and they can't get away from it and they have to watch it, I think that can, even though it's graphic and straightforward, can be equally squirming.
Right. Well, I did a scene in the Blood Red Isle, which is about entering this... a room that turns out to be a room where people were being cannibalized. And even though it's kind of a gore scene, in some sense it's an old scene, the fact is that the characters have to move through this room and see these gruesome sights, because it's not happening, it's happened long ago. So you have the gruesome, you have the setup that you figure out that's what was going on in this room. They have to move through, and as they're moving through, they're seeing kind of the shadows, the echoes of what happened there once. And the squirm becomes, in the minds of the readers, as you describe, what's left of something that was truly horrific there. And because in this case, the characters literally have to move through this room to get to the next place that they're going to, the readers have to take that journey with them too. And hopefully, as you describe, what's left, even though it's not happening now, people are not being eaten and butchered in this room now, the description of the remnants allow the reader's imagination to fill in what did happen, and the horror and the squirm plays out in their minds in a scene like that.
Yeah, and we should take your question.
Yeah, you have a question.
You were saying earlier that you have to trap the reader there. How do you do that? Because you were just saying that a lot of the stories, the only reason they're going into this place is sheer curiosity.
Yeah.
How do you, after the curiosity ends, how do you hook them and make them go through?
Well, one way that for me that I sort of would want to do that for, I mean, there are numerous ways, but for example, if the character is trying to get to a point here, and the reader wants to see them get there, if you crafted a story that has made it compelling enough to the reader that they want to see the character get through, and they hit the squirm point here, the reader feels they have to go through it because they want to find out what's on the other end. You know, it's sort of like the gauntlet. They're going to go through the gauntlet, they're going to feel pushed to go through the gauntlet because they want to get there, and at that point you've got them. Because if you've created a compelling enough story, they're going to read through it, even though the whole time they're reading going, oh, please, oh, are we through yet? And when they finally get through, they're like, oh, I'm so happy for the character, because God knows I would not have wanted to be there. You know, right, that's one way you could do it.
And that's actually the story that I was talking about, is almost literally it's a gauntlet. It's a 10 Little Indians kind of story. And the question becomes, how many people are they going to lose? How are they going to die? What kind of grisly things are going to happen until they get to their goal, which they've all agreed that they're getting to the goal. It's not just people wandering into the haunted house. I mean, we've all seen these movies where you wander into the haunted house, people start getting killed.
Poor drunk, horny kids wandering into a haunted house.
And they, there's a window there, and rather than jump out the window and run the hell away, they back up against the wall and scream. It's like, dumbass, there's a window there. Just jump out and keep going. And a good movie, they'll give you a reason why they don't jump out the window and keep going, but a lot of them don't.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, and it gets to our craft. We have to give the motivation. There has to be motivation for the character to go in there. The character needs to go in there, as you say, Mark, to get from point A to point C, has to go through point B. There can be peer pressure. There can be a desire to get away from something more frightening, but there's something that compels the character to go in there. Mark, getting back to your question, which I think is an excellent one that takes us to the next level here in this discussion. What about the outright gore scenes, the over the top violent scenes? Now those can make us squirm as well as we're reading them. I said a moment ago that there is a release at that point. However, there are some writers who are able to write violence so it is not a release. That there is an immense amount of tension as it is happening, and the reader will continue to read because there are things the reader needs to know. And I think the writer who does this better than anyone is not generally considered a genre writer, but I think it's Cormac McCarthy. And if we take a look at Blood Meridian, there must have been about 10 times in Blood Meridian when I was squirming to the point where I wanted to put the book down. We're talking over-the-top violence, massacre, bloodshed, people being cut apart in the most imaginable ways. But I had to keep reading because he had planted so many questions in my mind. I wanted to get to the next scene. I wanted to get through the mayhem to the aftermath so I could have them hash through it and talk about it, and I would learn a little bit more about this macabre tapestry that he was weaving. So I think that that book, if you can stand it, and I guarantee you, you will squirm as you read it, Blood Meridian, which certainly is a horror novel, but not marketed that way. The other one that might be better known is the Pulitzer Prize winner, The Road, by Cormac McCarthy as well, which also has a lot of squirm-inducing moments in it, although not the over-the-top violence. I think that The Road has a scene in it for me, which is a lot like what I was talking about in the first half of this discussion, where the father is on a boat. The boat is mired right offshore, and leaves his son on shore and says, don't go away, stay here, and then goes into the boat and ends up spending a lot more time on the boat than he anticipated. And the whole time I'm reading that scene, and it's minutiae of what the father is doing. He sees this, he sees this. None of the stuff he sees is really frightening. He sees canned goods, he sees boxes of stuff, he sees rope. But it's all described in such great detail that it takes pages and pages. And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, what's happening?
Right.
And he goes back outside. Well, I won't spoil it for you, but it's a great scene. But getting back to what you were saying, it's the mastery of the artist not to make the violence a release, but to have the violence something that we, the reader, has to go through in order to get to point C ourselves, because
right.
we want to see what's going to happen.
Well, and I think that another way that can work is that we tie ourselves as readers to the character we're reading about, whether we want to or not, whether they're a good person or a bad person. when they experience something horrible, we feel a need for absolution, for cleansing. We want to keep going because we're hoping that that author is going to take us and make things better. Because mm-hmm. we're going to be like, we have just been party to something horrible, whether it was the main character's fault or whether they just witnessed it. We want to come through so that we too can experience the cleansing and absolution that we're hoping the character will get. Now, in some cases, Thomas Covenant, you wait a long time for anything even close to absolution. And what I think happens sometimes there is that we psychologically, just like physically, when you go into a noisy room, your ears get numbed eventually to the noise and it's not so loud. Psychologically, they've studied this and the same thing happens. So if you keep pushing it over and over for too long, at some point the reader becomes numb and they no longer feel that need for absolution and cleansing, and they may not keep going. But as long as you can just take them almost to that point, they'll keep going because they're like, going, I don't want to see any more, but we have to get through this so that I can get to the happy place beyond. So.
Well, and you can also, you can manipulate in such ways that you, and after having had some gruesome scenes, you suddenly have a violent scene that kind of twitches things off in a completely different direction. And if you kill, say, a minor character, a character that the people didn't think was going to be killed, and suddenly you've got the group of characters left, and suddenly one of them is dead in such a way that the readers realize that what is happening, what they are facing, is much, much more than they thought they were. That, you know, they walk through the cannibals, and they walk through the death traps, and they walk through all this stuff, and suddenly they think they're home free, and something twists. And suddenly people start dying that you thought were the core group left. At that point, you've got, in the reader's mind, everything is now in jeopardy, and they need to find out at that point who's going to survive this thing. And that suspense, it's like, are they going to be smart enough? Are they going to be brave enough? Are they going to get out? Or is everyone going to die at the end of this thing? And people, if you can do that, you know, and I hope I have a couple of times, people will read through to the end just to find out what's going on. Now, I tend to have redemptive endings a lot, if not happy endings, because I believe in that kind of absolution. Because you don't want to leave a reader's feeling down. In fact, I wrote a kind of a very non-horrible story recently that was based on political events in Wisconsin where I live that so depressed my readers that I took them down so far that my little upturn at the end, they were like, that was an upturn?
Yeah, it's tricky, and I think that you make a good point. It's tricky, and I don't know if there's a magic formula. It's more, you know, practicing it, getting good at it, having people read it, seeing what sort of reactions you get.
Yeah, and trusting your gut, because, you know, I'm not sure it's, once you descend into formula, I don't like to write anything in the formula. Once you descend into formula, people can figure it out, and then they're going to stop swarming.
Now, Lawrence, you believe in taboos. Are there areas where you think that just there's no reason to go there?
Yeah, I think so. By the way, is Satan breathing? I mean, I hear the...
Yeah.
That's because it's the Robert Wise thing.
I love this panel. Yeah.
Didn't you notice the door bulging there? Hold my hand.
I mean, yeah. I do hear that, right? I mean, it's yeah, okay, right? I mean, it's not, you know.
You're one. It would be my aspect.
You're one.
Yeah.
Wasn't fast enough.
Are there taboos that you can't cross? Sure, I think so. I think the writers that hit them and pull it off, give us the... The better art. Another example, this example we can really talk about because it's a book you've either read or you're not going to read it. How about The Stand? How about the first chapter of The Stand? We have a family in a station wagon. I'm thinking I remember this correctly. And, you know, and I think family is something that is a taboo. You know, don't hurt the family. They haven't done anything wrong. The kid hasn't done anything wrong. And they're all sick, as I recall. You know, there's snot and congestion. And the dad is driving the station wagon. He's so sick he can't concentrate on the road. So in the first few pages, we are with this family. They're all suffering. They're sick. We can identify with sickness. We don't have any reason for them to be suffering like this, so we're feeling terrible about it. And then I believe the father drives in to a gas station, drives over the pump, and the man inside the gas station goes for the shutoff valve. He doesn't shut it off in time. There's a huge explosion, and the family died for no reason. I think that that is potentially a taboo. And when I was first reading The Stand, when it first came out, before the longer edition, this one was only 800, 900 pages, I thought, do I really want to stay with this for 900 pages? And I did, because King described it in such a remarkable way. He is a fine writer. And so I stuck with him because I trusted him to take me to some interesting places. But that was a book that I almost put down for that reason. So I think, you know, harming kids.
That's a tough one.
Harming an innocent
family. That
makes
me squirm.
Harming a dog. Harming a cat. I'm watching Twister with my, this is a long time ago, with my daughter. And she was maybe 5 or 6. And you know, if you've seen the Michael Crichton film Twister, there's a twister coming. Everybody goes into the storm cellar. Kid goes down, mom goes down, dog goes down, dad goes down. No, kid goes down, mom goes down, dad goes down.
Realize
the doors close. The kid says, "Where's the dog?" And my daughter's going, "The dog, the dog!" And she is squirming like crazy. And we hear, "Woof, woof." It's a little Toto dog, right?
Scratching
at the door. Okay, now get this. Okay, so dad has to go out for the dog, right? So dad opens the door. My daughter's in tears. Oh, the dog is not going to be in jeopardy. So you don't want to hurt the dog. The dad opens the storm window, and the dog comes down. My daughter, oh, and then the twister comes, and dad gets sucked away. She doesn't care. So you can hurt dad, right? I mean, no big deal. If dad had been driving the station wagon, Stephen King story, and blowing his nose and hit the gas station and blew up, okay. But the kid in the car, that really got me. And the dog in the, you know, being safe or being in jeopardy and then being safe, when it was in jeopardy, that really got my daughter. So I think dogs, cats, little helpless animals, little helpless kids, basically any entity that is unable to defend itself and also innocent of any crime, that enters into the area of danger. You need to be careful. You might very well lose readers.
And I think he makes a great point about Stephen King, because I've had that a few times in Stephen King books, where I start reading, I'm going, I don't actually want to read any more of this type of a story, but I trust him enough. The problem is that unless Stephen King is here, I don't know if he made it, most of us aren't Stephen King, and the reader probably won't trust us to take them through.
Yep.
And so we need to be very cautious. It's not that we can't take risks. It's not that we can't tackle taboos. But we do need to keep in mind the realities of the business we're in, because in the end of the day, it's a business. And if the reader is not going to trust us, then we probably can't do it.
I want to push the buttons. I want to make people uncomfortable, make them squirm. I want to make them care, but I don't want them to put the book down. Mm-hmm. Unless they go, oh! And then they pick it right back up.
That put it down. Yeah, there's a question here that I want to put to you.
Talking about Stephen King, I noticed he does that a lot, but I'm pretty sure, didn't he write The Mist?
Yes.
And he had that particular ending, which personally I thought was fabulous, but I ran into so many people who just say that was the worst thing he ever did.
Yeah.
And I was just concerned. It's kind of, I don't know if there's a squirm moment anymore. See, I was still squirming at the end, even though the movie was over. I was still squirming over what he did. You know, so I was just wondering what your opinion was. That a resolution? Is it over? Or did you think he meant to do that as a still squirming moment?
Talking about the movie or the book?
I think the book got it right. The book has a different ending. And actually, the ending in the book is in the movie.
And then they add to it, right?
Because
I haven't read the book, but when I got to the movie, I thought, no, I bet the book ended right here.
The book ends with that. I shouldn't do this, right? The book ends on a different note.
Does it end with people in the car?
However, Stephen King did say when the movie came out that he liked that ending. They liked that new ending. I didn't care for it. I thought that that was there was no place for me to go after that in the movie. There was no further promise. It just left me there, and I still didn't like it.
It's really hard for movies to end on an open ending, though, and not close things up. That audiences expect a complete story. They expect closure. Modern audiences, especially, don't want to leave a movie theater. Yeah. Asking questions, which is what I think, if I understand, the book left questions.
It did.
And possibilities. And the audience in a movie theater, you go to the test, they'll go, well, where's the end?
They want closure for their squirm.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they want to hit the closure point.
You know, but that can work. I think David Fincher's film Seven, which I hated when I first saw it, I thought that was the worst possible ending imaginable. And yet, I have come to really respect that. I've watched it many times since then, and I've come to admire that. But I've never felt compelled to give The Mist another viewing. I just think that that was such a disappointing.
In Seven, I just want to say, I think a lovely tool he used was when we knew what was in the box. And we all knew, even without seeing it, and knowing without him showing it to us was the worst part. It was the worst part. I mean, I get like freaked out just talking about it because it was so emotional. I think that's yet another example of where it's the knowing, it's the or not knowing. That is the thing. It's not the final scene. Now, we had someone right here.
I was just going to say that now that you've kind of brought up the taboos, right?
Yeah.
Don't threaten, or don't hurt family and innocence, right? You can also use that, though, as the motive. I mean, we were talking about going through the gauntlet of the squirm.
Oh, it can totally work. Right. It can. That's a good point.
Trying to save your kid.
It's a good point, and it can totally work. I guess all we were saying, I think, was just that you need to be a little cautious because those are taboos.
You need to be aware of it. You don't want people to put down your book, your story. You know?
Yeah, and if they, I mean, unless you're an artiste and you don't actually care if they buy any more of your books,
right.
Go for it, you know. She was next, I believe.
Since the idea is to get the readers, you know, their anticipation built up, and like you said, they their expectations end up being higher than the final reveal. Do you have trouble with like being afraid of disappointing your audience when you finally get to that final point?
I think that that's where the mastery comes in. Stephen King writes about this in Don's Macabre too, where he talks about the 100-foot bug, the 10-foot bug, and 100-foot bug. And if we open the door and there's a 10-foot bug out there, the reader will think, oh, well, that's frightening, but it could have been a 100-foot bug. It could have been more frightening. So I think that we really earn our pay when the reveal is interesting. And so it needs to be something unexpected. And we really need to plan those carefully. And I'm going to try to think about this for a moment. Reveals that really paid off. Come back to me, and I'll see if I can come up with
one. For me, the Lovecraft reveal that is not a reveal at the end of a lot of his stories really work. I know some people don't like that, but the fact that you can get to the end of a Lovecraft story where you know what the horror is, and he'll give you a final hint to it, but he'll never actually show it to you. Mm-hmm. He'll leave that to your imagination. Like, when that works, I think that's just brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that's just wonderful.
Gentlemen back there.
Okay. So your plot requires that the innocent kid gets tortured and killed. How do you handle that without pissing off our readers?
Yeah.
Good question. Depends on who your readers are sometimes.
Lovely Bones, I think, does that.
That's what I'm concerned. Yeah, if you need the nice lady to get raped, make her not nice lady, and then you kind of, she's not innocent anymore. But I don't know, is that a natural?
No, I think that The Lovely Bones is a good example, the book The Lovely Bones, not the Peter Jackson film, but because here we have the innocent person being murdered right at the very beginning, and it's a horrible scene. But what happens later is the character continuing to observe what her life without her in it from the afterlife. And if I'm reading your question, maybe I'm avoiding your question, but how do we portray that in service of story and keep the story going? I think that there needs to be elements that we want to see resolved, and we do want to see that in The Lovely Bones. If a child is kidnapped and killed at the beginning of a story, we want to see the perpetrator brought to justice. That was done recently in a book. I'm blanking on the title, but the child goes missing, and we want to see the child's murder avenged.
Well, and to be cinematic about it a little bit, it can depend upon whether you're going to let your camera linger, or whether you're going to turn away and let the imagination fill in the gruesomeness. For me, you know, child killing as a parent, boy, I don't know any parent that doesn't squirm when you start killing children. And if you're telling me you're going to kill a child, and you've got it on camera, so to speak, in your story, and then you pan away and you give me a sound and blood splatter. Boy, that's more than enough to make me squirm, but it's probably not enough to make me head for the door. The Lovely Bones, I haven't read because I've heard about that opening, and I'm like, I don't care what the payoff is. Yeah. I am not going
to
read
it. Yeah, my wife started to read it, just put it down. Now, one thing I would say, though, is that the first question I'd ask you is, do you really need to go there? Can you do the same thing in a better way? Because, and I'm not suggesting this is what you're doing or something, but sometimes it represents someone just not working hard enough. And everyone's going to hate me for this, but Quentin Tarantino is one of the worst. Rather, he uses the most obvious, you didn't see that coming, ooh, did that creep you out, smell this type of thing, as story. And it's not, that's not story. You have to work hard at it, and sometimes if you find yourself using something like that, I'd ask myself right away, if I worked a little harder, could I use something that doesn't break the taboo and yet still is as effective and powerful for my reader? It's going to be a lot harder to do, but I'm not going to risk that. I'm not going to read this moment. Okay? And now this gentleman's waiting a lot.
I'm just curious about the use of narrative conventions such as dramatic irony, where the reader knows more than the characters. Like, the reader knows there's a werewolf in the jungle, but the characters don't. The reader's squirming for the character. And also when to give breaths, when the reader gets some air, when to alleviate tension. I'm just curious about those two.
It needs to be dynamics. You need to have those breaths. You need to have comic relief. You need to have lulls. The story, if you look at music, if you put music on a visual field on your computer, you can see peaks and valleys. And in a good piece of music, you can tell by looking at it, you can tell that there are crescendos and there are low points. And in our writing, we need to do that. So how do you map that out? The way I learned it was just reading a lot of books and seeing how the pacing of those books went. I think that writers who are masters of that, I think Stephen King is very good at that. Giving us, for example, in Pet Sematary, which crosses these boundaries that we've been talking about. There are scenes of characters just sitting out on the porch and talking about their lives, and they're bucolic scenes. Another example is Thinner, with the Richard Bachman novel, which also puts family in jeopardy. And yet, because there are lulls in the story, there are moments of lovemaking, there are moments of real parental endearment to the child, these cleanse the palate for the violence that is to come. So
a lot of times in the movies anyway, you'll get that breath just before the big hit, the big shot, because it's like you seem to let the audience off the hook, and then suddenly they're right back on and things are worse than they ever imagined they were. And that could be very effective. I do want to say again that I think relying on any formula like that is hazardous because it cheapens what you're doing. And, you know, if there comes a point where you're a writer where you do a lot of things, I do a lot of analyzing of my writing, but I also do a lot of things by instinct. Just by sheer mass of years of doing this, years of reading, years of watching cinema that I like, and I'm a very cinematic writer. So sometimes you just have to feel it. You have to feel like, okay, this is going too far. If it starts to feel tedious to you as a writer, if it starts to not be that pleasant squirm, my thought is that chances are your readers are going to feel the same thing. I mean, to jump outside from what we're talking about, there are times as a writer when you're working on a long project when you may find yourself sitting down and having characters say, well, gee, there's nothing really going on. And at that point, the characters are talking through you and telling you, hey, writer, there's nothing going on in your book. And you need to bring that back to what we're talking about. You need to be able to pay attention to the feeling inside yourself and kind of trust your gut and listen to the little voice. The little voice is telling you something.
I think
it's probably right.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I thought you were breathing.
I know, I was just setting you up for that.
I was like, oh, sorry. We have time for one last question. Way in the back, you were waiting for a while.
With the popularization, sort of normalization of Black classic horror, entire paranormal romance section now. Do you think that it's having a negative impact on the genre, or is the potential to open the doors there?
Twilight, yes.
Just to put the on sort of old character type.
That's a good question.
I'm not really fond of taming vampires or werewolves or any other thing. I like monsters.
I think the squirm inducement that you get from those books is a romantic squirm. You know, we have
the Twilight makes me squirm, but not in a good way.
You know, you're right. But to the defense of Twilight, the David Slade film, Twilight Eclipse, I think shows us what Twilight can be.
Was that the last one?
That was the most recent.
Yeah, that was all right.
And David Slade is the same director that made Hard Candy and 30 Days of Night. And this guy really knows how to push the horror buttons, and he knows how to make a good film. And in David Slade's hands, the third film had good horror tension in it, but it also had good romantic tension in it. Now, those of you who have read the book or seen the film, there is this scene where the vampire guy, what's his name?
Edward.
Edward is in the tent, and he's cold. He's cold-blooded. He can't give off any heat. And Bella is there, and Bella is freezing. She's losing heat, and here's the werewolf Indian boy, and he's got a high body temperature. Now, he can get naked and get in the sleeping bag with her, and they can cuddle up, and he can save her life. He can save Bella's life. And what a terrific squirm-inducing scene as it's played in the film. Now, Stephanie Meyer's writing tends to be kind of telling. She doesn't show, she tells. But in the film, when this is shown, and we have Edward outside the sleeping bag looking at this and knowing that this is necessary to save Bella's life, and we have the werewolf Indian boy really enjoying this, and we have Bella, who I believe is either asleep or close to unconsciousness through most of the scene, kind of
most
oblivious to it.
Sorry.
But just to answer your question, so I think that you know, love tension, romantic tension, sexual tension can also give us the same kind of squirm as horrific and violent tension.
So we're just about out of time. I'm going to have you just say a last thing. Before I do that, though, I want to remind everybody that there are readings in here. I think it's in this room or the one next door, every day at lunch and at dinner. Bring your food. Come on up. It's awesome. Honestly, people start coming to these and just keep coming. It's the best free entertainment at the con. You can hear some great stories, so make sure to do that. I'll start with just a closing statement that... No, actually, I'll let one of you guys go. Steve, you want to go?
Yeah, I'm working on a horror series of horror novels right now, and I'm rewriting the first one. I started it 15 years ago. And, you know, aside from the obvious, well, gosh, I was not such a good writer then as I am now rewriting, one of the things that I'm really trying to do is work more on the psychological horror and that kind of thing. And it's something we didn't touch on in our squirm thing, but something that I'm trying to do in this is to touch people where they live, and it's something they might be comfortable with that is semi-taboo, and then just pushing it a little further, just pushing things where you go, oh, I can see someone dressing up and doing this, and then I'll push it a little further, and where suddenly it starts off like, well, this seems like a harmless game, and even though it's a slight taboo, and now it's become dangerous. And that's a technique we didn't touch on, and I'm working on it hard right now.
That's cool.
All right, as Mark said, the readings, I'll be doing a reading tomorrow at 5, and I'll be reading short excerpts, which will have squirm-inducing moments in them, and I hope comfortable squirms, enjoyable squirms. We can continue the conversation then, if you're available tomorrow at 5.
And the last thing I wanted to say is one thing that I've learned doing the reading critiques and the writing critiques here is that a lot of times new authors get in their head that you come out of the gate being good or not being good. That there is this, there's no middle ground. And we're talking about these techniques and how do you do it and how do you get it right? By doing it again and again and again. This truly is, it's like becoming a really good basketball player or a really good guitar player. You don't start out good. You start out not so good. And you just do it and you practice it. You analyze how other people do it. It's a craft and you can all get good at it. You just have to put in the time and work hard and you'll be squirming people as well.
And the wonderful thing is, as a writer, you can do that not just until you're 30 or 40.
That's right, like a basketball player.
You can get better and better and better. Your entire
You'll be rolling life. In with your oxygen tank, creeping everybody out.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for
thank
coming.
You. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for
thank
coming.
You. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for
thank
coming.
You. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for
thank
coming.
You. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for
thank
coming.
You. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank
Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.
That's not canon.